Good day, everyone, and welcome to today's program. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, you have the opportunity to ask questions during the question-and-answer session. You may register to ask a question at any time by pressing the star and one on your touchtone phone. You may withdraw yourself from the queue by pressing the pound key. Please note this call may be recorded, and I will be standing by should you need any assistance. It is now my pleasure to turn the conference over to Maria Elena Encampia. Please go ahead.
Thank you so much, Zach, and thanks everybody for joining us today on this call. We at the National Immigration Law Center are committed to fighting for a broad, direct, inclusive road to full citizenship with the least number of roadblocks possible. After taking time to review and analyze the 844 pages of the Senate bill, we thought it would be a good idea to share our analysis with you about the opportunities and challenges that low-income immigrants would face under the Senate bill. We also really want to hear from you. We want to get your questions and your comments of how you're seeing and how your members are seeing the Senate bill. Today, we are closer than ever to get an immigration reform bill through the finish line, and it's because of the incredible organizing and advocacy work that each of you have done. We are very grateful to each of you for the work you've done to get us here. This has ranged from many of you who've been working on the ground, fighting against deportations, against immigration raids in the workplace, at homes and restaurants, I-9 audits, to the Dreamers who have been leading the fight and actually got us the greatest victory, policy victory we've had in a really long time through the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, the incredible leadership of immigrants themselves, dating back to the 2006 rallies around the country, and many of the May 1st rallies across the country. And today, kind of on the vigil of our next big May 1st rallies across the country, we are very excited to be working with all of you side by side to try to get immigration reform passed and actually enacted into law so that we can take away the pain and suffering that has been plague in our communities and immigrant families who've been separated given our current immigration system and particularly our current deportation and detention policies. Today I'm sitting here in LA with an entire team of our incredible LA staff, and I know some of our other staff in DC and Oakland are on as well. On the call today we will hear from three of our stellar attorneys, Shuming Chair, Josh Stelick, and Sonal Ambegaokar, who will share different parts of the bill, starting with the legalization, DREAM, and the criminal bars that Shuming will be sharing. Josh will be sharing our workers' rights the provisions, and then Sonal will be talking about the health care and benefits and tax issues as well. We'll then open it up for Q&A and comments, and we do ask that you try to keep your questions as brief as possible so that we can hear from as many of you as possible. The call is being recorded, so we remind you about that and keep that in mind as you're asking your questions. We will send you a link to that recording so that you can post it on your website or share on your social media platforms and with many of your constituencies. So to start us off, I think we'll have Shuming kick us off with the first part of our presentation.
All right, thank you. So good morning or good afternoon to all of you, depending where you are. I'm actually going to go over the legalization provisions of the Senate Immigration Reform Bill, as well as touch on the DREAM Act provisions and the enforcement provisions. So just to start off, this bill creates a new status. It's called Registered Provisional Immigrant Status, or RPI for short. And so this is the status that people will be able to apply for and obtain as they begin the road to citizenship. And so for people to qualify initially for the RPI status, there's a couple of requirements. First, they have to physically be in the U.S. on or before December 31st, 2011. Second, they have to maintain continuous presence up until the date that they apply for this RPI status. Third, they have to pay any outstanding federal taxes that they owe. And fourth, people cannot have certain types of criminal convictions. These convictions include felonies, aggravated felonies, which is a term of art under immigration law and is a very broad term. Also, people with three or more misdemeanors, people who have gang-related conduct or convictions, certain foreign offenses, a conviction for unlawful voting would not be eligible for this RPI status. There is a waiver available, which I won't go into too much detail about at this point. It is available for some of these criminal convictions. And so one of our concerns is that many low-income immigrants are criminalized from any types of conduct, and our concern is that these people will then be excluded from being able to apply for this RPI status. So if people are eligible for this RPI status, they have to pay a $500 fine and also an application fee, which we don't know at this point how much that's going to be. They have until 1 year from the time that the Department of Homeland Security publishes the final regulations to apply for this status. People will also be able to petition for their family members. They just have to show that their spouse or child were in the U.S. before December 30th, 2012, and their spouse and children have to be in the U.S. at the time that the primary applicant is granted RPI status. Some of the good news is that for people who have had encounters with Department of Homeland Security, that they would still be eligible to apply for this RPI status. And so that includes people who were arrested by ICE before the application period, people in removal or deportation proceedings, and people who've already been ordered removed but have not left the U.S. The other good piece is that some folks who've left the U.S. due to a deportation order or a voluntary departure order would also be eligible to file for this RPI status. They would need a waiver to do so. And also for people who've been deported previously, returned to their home country, and then returned again to the U.S. without permission would also be eligible for a waiver to file for the RPI status. To qualify for the waiver, they have to show that they are the spouse, child, or parent of a person who is a U.S. citizen or a lawful permanent resident, and also Dreamers would qualify for this waiver. So the second step, after people are in this RPI status for 6 years, they can then renew their status. At that point, they have to pay another fine, which is $500, pay another application fee. There's more requirements at the renewal stage, so people have to show that they have been employed regularly, and that's defined as not having more than a 60-day gap in employment. There are some exemptions to this requirement, but we are overall concerned that it's going to be difficult for many low-income immigrants to be able to meet this requirement, or it'll be a burden for them to really document their continuous employment. People also have to show that they have income or resources above 100% of the federal poverty level, and at that point pay any back taxes that they've owed since they first were granted RPI status. Next step then for this fairly lengthy road is for people to apply for their lawful permanent or LPR status. They apply for that after 10 years. At that point, there's, again, fines. At this point, it's a $1,000 fine. There's an application fee. So at this point, currently the application fee for people to become LPRs is $985 plus $85 for biometrics. At that point, they, again, have to show that they've been employed regularly, also that they have income or resources above 125% of the federal poverty level, and that they are studying English and the history of the U.S. So as you can see, a lot of these requirements are fairly onerous, particularly for low-income immigrants, many of whom are living at or below the poverty level. And so one of our main concerns is that we want to make sure that this road to legalization is actually affordable and accessible for many low-wage workers. So I'm going to move on to the DREAM Act provisions. So we are pretty pleased that this bill contains fairly strong DREAM Act language. For somebody who is considered a Dreamer, basically they would have to show that they entered the U.S. before the age of 16, that they have their GED or high school diploma, and that they've either been attending higher education for 2 years or military service for 4 years. So for this, for the Dreamer, they have a quicker road to citizenship. They would basically be able to apply for the RPI status. After they apply for RPI status for 5 years, they then apply for the LPR status and could then immediately apply for their citizenship. So this is a fairly quick path for Dreamers. There's also, as I mentioned, a waiver for those who've been deported. The bill also makes it easier for states to provide in-state tuition for students regardless of their immigration status. So I'm going to just quickly also run through some of the enforcement provisions in the bill. Unfortunately, although we're currently living in a climate with a record number of deportations, this bill does widen the types of conduct and the types of convictions that would result in a person being deported from the U.S. This includes people who have convictions or conduct related to being part of a gang, It also relates to people who've committed three or more DUIs, and also for people who have certain domestic violence crimes, they would then be inadmissible from the U.S. So I think I will stop there. There's definitely a lot more enforcement provisions that we are very concerned about, but I'll see if there's any time to address those in the Q&A.
Great. Thanks, Xuming. And we realize that we're providing a lot of information, so we do want to keep our presentations brief and leave it up, and I think there'll be a lot more time in the Q&A. So, Josh, do you want to walk us through the workers' rights section?
Thanks for joining us. I'm going to talk about E-Verify and some other provisions in the bill specific to workers. I won't be able to touch on all of the worker-specific provisions as they are woven throughout the entirety of the bill, but I will highlight some of the major components. And I want to start with E-Verify since that's one of the biggest pieces of interior immigration enforcement within the bill and will have a dramatic impact on the hiring processes of all employers within the U.S., assuming the bill were to pass in its current state. I want to note at the outset that the bill calls for the national implementation of an electronic employment verification system. I refer to this as E-Verify because that's the largest, or rather the current version of an electronic employment verification system in existence. The bill, though, would make significant changes to that system, as I'll describe in more detail, so it will likely be somewhat different from the current E-Verify system. The bill would ultimately require all employers in the U.S. to use E-Verify to verify the employment eligibility of all newly hired employees or current employees who have expiring work authorization. Unlike the leaked White House bill, there's no E-Verify exception in the Senate bill for small employers of any size. The requirement to use E-Verify would be phased in over a five-year period depending on employer size. For example, employers of 5,000 or more employees would have to begin using E-Verify within 2 years of the implementing regs being published, and employers with more than 500 employees would have to begin using E-Verify within 3 years of the implementing regs, and all other employers within 4 years of the implementing regs being published. The bill contains new protections for workers in the E-Verify system that don't currently exist. Under the bill, an employer would run a newly hired employee through the E-Verify system and receive either a confirmation that the worker is eligible to work or may receive what the bill calls a further action notice, or FAN for short. The FAN indicates that the employee must take additional steps to verify his or her identity or employment authorization. If the employer receives a FAN, the employer must notify the employee of the FAN and provide the employee with information about the procedures to respond to it. An employer cannot take adverse action, including terminating the worker or revoking a job offer, against an employee because of a FAN. And the employee will have 10 business days to contact the appropriate federal agency in response to the FAN. The system will then provide a confirmation or non-confirmation of the employee's work eligibility within 10 days from when the employee contests the FAN. The bill also creates a multi-level review process for employees who receive an erroneous non-confirmation that they're not authorized to work when in fact they actually are. And that includes a first level administrative review process for workers, a next level of review, which would be an appeal to an administrative law judge, and finally an appeal to the U.S. Court of Appeals. And the bill also provides for an automatic stay of the non-confirmation during this review process, which means the non-confirmation would not go into effect while an employee is contesting the non-confirmation. I'll now turn to some of the worker protections within the bill. We're very pleased to see that the core principles of the Power Act are included in the bill. This means that the bill expands the availability of the U visa for workers who have experienced violations of their civil workplace rights. For those not familiar, the U visa is a form of immigration relief currently available to victims of certain crimes. The bill would make immigrant workers who had experienced significant workplace abuse or retaliation also eligible for a U visa, and the bill increases the total number of U visas available each year from the current cap of 10,000 to 18,000. The bill would also enable a worker who has filed a workplace claim, who's a material witness in a workplace claim, or who has filed for a U visa, eligible to obtain a stay of removal for up to 3 years and work authorization during that period. So there's many more many more issues and provisions pertaining to workers in the bill, which hopefully we can talk about in the Q&A.
Thanks, Josh. And so our next and final speaker before we open it up for Q&A is Sonal.
Good afternoon or good morning, everybody. I'm Sonal Ambigaukar. I'm the health policy attorney, and my presentation might be short because there was a lot of things that wasn't included in the bill that's related to health and public benefits. I want to remind folks or bring us back to current law and current status for healthcare access so you can see that it's pretty much remained unchanged. Currently, undocumented immigrants are pretty much ineligible for everything, including the ACA, where you can actually buy insurance at full cost. So they were specifically excluded for that, and they've always been ineligible for Medicaid, non-emergency Medicaid, TANF, SSI, SNAP, and other benefit programs. There are some programs that are available regardless of status that will remain so, but for the most part, the status quo is undocumented immigrants are ineligible for most benefits. Legal immigrants or lawfully present immigrants often are also required to wait 5 years before being able to apply for benefits. So even if you're low income and you meet all the other criteria for these programs, once you get your green card, you are still required to wait another 5 arbitrary years, and that is a result of welfare reform. Finally, under the ACA, the definition of who is eligible for tax credits and cost-sharing reductions is lawfully present immigrants. So if you're lawfully here, you should be able to buy in the exchange and also apply for tax credits and cost-sharing reductions. And those are all based on your income and only available if you are a tax filer. Under S-744, there are two main provisions in the bill that exclude any of the new statuses from both federal public benefits and the ACA. And I will go into the details now. So in the definition that's used in the Senate bill, the language is that they are RPIs, as Shuming has said, V visa holders, blue card holders are all ineligible for federal means-tested benefits. What that definition refers to is 5 specific programs, which is non-emergency Medicaid, SNAP, which is formerly known as food stamps, TANF, which is the welfare program, SSI, which is Supplemental Security Income, and CHIP, which is the Children's Health Insurance Program. So these statuses are specifically excluded and made ineligible for these benefit programs during the time that they're lawfully here in their provisional status. Once they get their green card, and the times vary based on each of these statuses, they must wait another 5 years under the PERARA rules. So at a minimum, we're looking at, for Dreamers, for example, 5 years before they can enroll in any of these programs. For an RPI, it's going to be 15 years. It'll be 10 years in provisional status plus another 5 years. Under the ACA, they are not none of these statuses are eligible for tax credits and cost-sharing reductions. They can buy in the exchange at full cost. And as of right now, the language in the bill would require them to buy health insurance. They can request an exemption based on affordability or hardship based on existing ACA rules. However, the exemption from the mandate may happen as an amendment in future committee work. So they might actually be exempt from the mandate because they were excluded from the ACA. As the last point, eligibility for employer coverage is the same for any of these workers as other citizen or other lawfully present workers. There should be no difference in employer health coverage, and they're eligible. All these statuses are eligible during the provisional status for emergency Medicaid and other programs such as the community health centers, school lunches, and public health services. There's no change in eligibility for a mixed status family for EITC, which is the Earned Income Tax Credit, or the Child Tax Credit, CTC. So mixed status families who also have provisional status members, there should be no change in eligibility for them. I think that those are the main points I wanted to make, and I'll reserve my time for questions. Thanks.
Great. Thank you, Sonal. So as we, Zach, maybe you could give folks instructions on how to queue up if they have a question before we, so we can get started on Q&A.
Sure. And if you'd like to ask a question, it's star and one to enter the question queue. You can remove yourself by hitting the pound key. Again, it's star and one if you have a question.
Great. Thank you, Zach. And in the meantime, as folks are doing that, please try to remember to keep your phones on mute if you are not asking a question. And for those of you that are, try to pick up the phone rather than being on speaker, et cetera, to try to minimize as much background noise as possible. As you heard from all of the presentations, and again, these are really just the highlights of the very complex 844-page bill. It is a very complicated bill. The Senate Gang of Eight, and especially their staffers, did an incredible job negotiating some very difficult provisions. NILC staff has been working very closely with both the Senate Judiciary staff as well as the House Judiciary staff, although in the last couple of months, our focus has been primarily on the Senate, as well as we've been working with the White House. There are some really great provisions in here, some gems, as I like to refer to them, that we will have to protect. However, as you also heard, there are many provisions that we have some very serious concerns about. They're both things that were included in the bill and then things that were omitted from the bill, like folks being excluded from the ACA's tax credits as well. So while we wait for folks to queue up, I'm going to start with a question for Xuming, since I know we didn't get through much of the enforcement section. Xuming, could you maybe just walk us through what the criminal grounds of exclusion are, what would make somebody eligible or ineligible? And then I know some of the questions we've gotten a lot from folks on the ground, especially in states where we're litigating, like Georgia, Alabama, Arizona, are what happens if somebody has been convicted of an immigration-related felony, for example, or a misdemeanor? How will people fare under the Senate bill?
So in terms of the criminal exclusions for somebody to actually legalize and become an RPI, to be an RPI status, so there's several different convictions that would prevent somebody from obtaining the status. That includes any state or federal felony. There is an exception to certain status-based offenses. Also, one aggravated felony, which, as I alluded to briefly before, is a really widely encompassing term and includes many types of convictions that are not actually felonies and many types of minor convictions for which people don't serve any or very little time in jail. Also, if people have three misdemeanors, they won't be eligible to apply for RPI status. There is an exemption for the misdemeanor bar if people have minor traffic offenses and also certain status-based convictions. And so this does address what Marilena was talking about in terms of if people are criminalized and convicted for crimes related to being undocumented under certain state laws, there is an exception for that. The problem is that in some states, such as Arizona, we've been seeing that law enforcement has been aggressively targeting immigrants and actually charging them with crimes that are not related directly to their status. This could be a crime for using a false ID or identity theft. And so in those cases, it's ambiguous. I mean, it appears that currently that would not be an exemption, and I think that's an area that we have to really look out for and continue to advocate to make sure that people targeted by law enforcement in that way are still eligible to apply for RPI status. Also, as I mentioned, there's certain foreign convictions that would bar somebody from this RPI status. Unfortunately, there's a new gang-related ground that would bar people, and that's either for gang-related convictions or potentially for being a member of a gang. And some other exceptions, as I mentioned, is just the minor traffic offenses.
Great. Thanks, Xuming. Zach, do we have any questions lined up?
We do have a few questions in queue. We'll go first to Kathleen Kim out of Loyola Law School. Please go ahead.
Hi, Marielena. Hi, Xuming.
Hey,
thanks so much for doing this. I had a question related to the worker-related provisions in the bill. I was wondering what your thoughts on whether it strikes the right balance between mandating E-Verify over this period of time, but then also expanding worker protections in other areas. Or are there additional red flags in the bill that that we should watch out for that might circumvent worker protections in other areas that weren't mentioned.
Great. Thanks, Kathleen. Josh, do you want to take a crack?
In terms of E-Verify, this is a difficult issue for us. NILC has historically been opposed to a mandatory E-Verify system and remains so primarily or at least partly because of the error rates that are contained in the underlying databases that an electronic employment verification system relies upon, and we know from past government studies that those error rates have a disproportionate impact on non-citizen workers. That said, we are very pleased to see that the Senate bill does contain pretty robust worker rights protections for workers who are erroneously identified as not work authorized through the E-Verify system, and that the bill creates a formal review process for workers who have been tagged with an erroneous non-confirmation, which doesn't currently exist. So we are pleased to see that those worker protections and due process safeguards have been included in the Senate bill, and think those are very important for any mandatory electronic employment verification system that's going to go forward. We're also very pleased about the inclusion of the Power Act. There are some other good worker protections in the bill, including a potential fix to the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Hoffman Plastics v. NLRB. And the bill also cracks down on abuses in foreign labor contracting and provides new protections for workers who are recruited abroad as part of the foreign labor contracting process. So there are some other good worker protections in the bill that I didn't have time to outline in my initial remarks.
Great. Thanks, Josh. Zach, next question.
And we'll go next to Kathleen Zittler with Interfaith Coalition. Please go ahead.
Hi. Thanks, everyone, for the good work. My question is, many of us in the religious community, as a rabbi myself, our question is that why is there a big difference between the length of time for the dreamers and the, say, the regular workers and farm workers in the time it takes them to become citizens? Why is that?
So it's a great question. I think the short answer is political power. The Dreamers have done an incredible amount of organizing and advocacy, and including everything from civil disobedience to sitting in Senator McCain's office, and also because they've been able to achieve with many of our, both NILC and many of our allies, support the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrival. So since many of them would be in this temporary status, they're also included, though we do think that needs to be streamlined. Similarly for ag workers, for the farm workers, right? They have been advocating and organizing for a really long time with the ag industry to try to get onto a road to citizenship. So those two groups of workers definitely have a faster path. I think from NILC's perspective, we believe everybody should have that same quick road to citizenship. But unfortunately, that's not the case. And in fact, as you probably know, and I think we may have mentioned this, I think Xuming mentioned it, there's an initial cutoff period of December 31st of 2011 by which people would have had to enter. So that alone excludes a certain set of people who entered after that, which, you know, these are all definite concerns. Thank you. Next question, Zach?
And just as a reminder, it is star and one if you would like to ask a question. We'll go next to Vanessa Saavedra with California Primary Care Associates. Please go ahead.
Hello, thank you. So my question has to do with the overlap with health care reform and the increasing need for more health care industry workers. And I'm wondering if you can speak to any of the provisions of the immigration reform bill that might help with some of the workforce issues that healthcare providers are having in terms of visas or anything like that, that might have an effect on that workforce.
Great. Thanks for your question, Vanessa. Josh, do you want to get us started? It's more on the workforce development side.
I think on the workforce development side, I mean, just the availability of the RPI status will have a huge impact on home health
healthcare workers in particular, which we know is an area of the workforce that has a fairly high concentration of immigrant workers, and particularly female immigrant workers. So under this bill, if they meet the requirements that Xuming laid out, those workers would, who currently, by and large, don't have, if they're here without authorization, don't have an option to legalize their status, would have a roadway to citizenship that is not currently available. There's also I didn't touch on this in my remarks, the bill also does provide for a new type of visa called a W visa, which is available for certain types of lower skilled workers to come to the U.S. Legally going forward, and we believe that would also be potentially available for a future flow of home health care workers.
Great. And Vanessa, the only thing I would add as well is the H-2B and H-1B, so higher skilled worker visas, are still in existence as well, and we aren't covering those topics on this call, but really that is a whole other area where nurses and other healthcare workers will be able to come in, and I think there continue to be concerns about the level of worker protections available for those workers as well as for U.S. workers. Zach, next question.
And we'll go next to Isabel Anadon with Latino Policy Forum. Please go ahead.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I'm on speaker, so I apologize for the background noise and if you can't get my question, but thank you so much for this call. My question is related to, you know, as we prepare for the May month of markups in the Senate, I think one of the speakers alluded to at least one amendment that will be introduced related to the requirements, the exemption for health care for undocumented immigrants and the RPI status. Can the speakers talk a little bit more about any other friendly amendments that are expected that have potential to improve the current bill? And perhaps on the flip side, what are some of the negative amendments that we should be watching out for, and anything that we can do to advocate for both sides?
Great. Thank you so much for your question, Isabel. So as you mentioned, the markup is about to start next Thursday. We could have a whole other call, and maybe we will, on the markup and the amendment strategy. That's all still being worked out by the Senate Judiciary, particularly by Chairman Leahy's staff, in terms of even just the order in which they'll take amendments, what the rules will be around taking amendments. I know from recent meetings they really want to focus on amendments that actually will pass. And, you know, I'll just open it up to different NILC staff members to share kind of what some of the amendments that we are seeing as priorities that need to be introduced. There is going to be a whole slew of really bad amendments. So I don't know that we'll take up too much time here today, but maybe Sonal, do you want to start on the healthcare?
Sure. I think many of you know that NILC has been working for years to remove the five-year waiting period. We were successful during the children's health insurance reform, but we weren't able to remove it during health care reform. So again, we're going, if possible, we're going to attempt to remove it here again for lawfully present immigrants. And if not, maybe we could find a way to deem the time that served in provisional status towards the five-year bar, so there wouldn't be an additional 5 years they would have to wait. It's just, for us, it's a matter of fairness.
And I think on the negative side of that, maybe do you want to share what some of the concerns are?
The concerns are, and as many of you know, on health and benefits, the facts don't matter. The opposition will continue to claim all these immigrants have access to all these fantastic benefits. So we're going to have to make sure that the status quo at least remains. So things like even emergency Medicaid, that remains available. Regardless of status. Other challenges could be additional waiting requirements. So if 15 years isn't enough, maybe they'll try to add another 10 years. So all of those things, it will actually make the bill worse in terms of additional time to wait for benefits. But I think we're also worried about just a do no harm. So at least existing status should remain the way that it is for benefits and health care.
Great, thanks, Sonal. Xuming, do you want to share on the other affirmative amendments?
Well, I just wanted to mention quickly that although there's a lot of aspects of the bill that we do find problematic, as I alluded to the increased criminalization, there's also a section of the bill that changes the process by which a person could obtain a waiver from deportation. It's also not a perfect waiver and not nearly as broad as perhaps we would like it to be in our ideal world, but I think in a lot of enforcement areas, we're in a world of being defensive where although we don't think the waiver is strong enough and we think that there's already too many bars to legalization, we might have to very well defend what's already in the bill and make sure that it doesn't get worse and it doesn't exclude more people. Great. Josh?
In the workers' rights context, I think as Shuming has also mentioned, we're going to have to both look at affirmative amendments and also defensive amendments to protect the good things that are in the bill. In terms of affirmative amendments, we do hope that there will be some improvements to the E-Verify system that's laid out in the Senate bill. In particular, the Senate bill basically provides a notice of an employee's eligibility to work to the employer and then requires the employer to share that information with the employee. We would like to see the employee have a right to get that information directly either from the system or at least to have a good cause provision for an employee whose employer failed to provide him or her with information about the further action notice and how to contest it, to have additional time to be able to contest that notice if the employer hasn't complied with their affirmative obligations under the bill. So we do think there are some sort of cleanup fixes to the E-Verify system that we would like to see affirmatively included through an amendment process.
Great. Thanks, Zach. Next question.
And we'll go next to Mark Gorilla with Sunflower. Please go ahead.
All right. Let's see if I can remember my questions. But one question I have is for the Dreamers. Does it start for them like when the CAR passes, or does it start from when their DACA started? So that's one question that I have.
Great, thank you. And Mark, you're calling from Sunflower Action in Kansas?
Correct.
Great. Thanks for all your work.
Yeah, so the bill states that for Dreamers, they would apply for RPI status after this bill becomes law. There is language saying that the Secretary can establish a streamlined process for people with DACA. It's not clear yet what that means exactly, if that process is going to look like the process for Dreamers, because the two groups are very similar, but they're not necessarily identical. But yes, to answer your question in brief, Dreamers would apply for the RPI status after the bill passes.
Okay. An additional question I have for that, and it's kind of like what information might you guys have additional for that? So 1 year is what it's going to be available for, as far as realistic goes, for 11 million, right?
Mark, are you saying 1 year, the application period?
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah. It's 1 year from the time that the final regulations are published, and the Secretary can also extend that for 18 more months. And so I know that's an issue of concern because we saw under 1986 IRCA legalization, a lot of people just never applied. So I think it's going to be, if that's what becomes part of the law, we're going to have to really think about ways to do really intensive outreach and make sure that as many people as possible are able to apply.
And that's definitely one of those areas of amendments that we will be advocating for and that we actually think even USCIS and others who will be part of the implementation process will be. It's just definitely not enough time, as we've seen even with DACA alone.
Exactly, even preparing for it. So
That's right. Mark, did you have any other questions?
I think that ends my questions. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Next question, Zach.
And just as a reminder, it is *N1 if you would like to ask a question. Also, if you can identify where you're calling in from when you ask your question. We'll go next to Julia Kohler with AAP. Please go ahead.
Hi, this is Julia. I'm calling as a member of the Immigrant Health Special Interest Group of the American Academy of Pediatrics. And I have questions related to the experience of patient families of mine and of ours. Firstly, several of my patient parents are affected by this criminalization to directly immigration-related issues such as reentering the country after having been deported, but also indirectly, for example, which is not, you know, ostensibly immigration related, but in fact totally is, such as driving without a license. And here in Massachusetts, certain town police have been targeting people who look like immigrants for that particular offense very strenuously. So my question is, will it be possible to exclude those so-called offenses from criteria that make it impossible to apply for the status? And my second question, I have some both patients but also parents of patients who might be eligible for the Dreamer status, but for various different reasons are not going to be having 2 years of college. And among those reasons are that really, in my experience, the level of education anybody has is simply a direct function of the income of their parents. And number two, I know other kids who dropped out of high school because they were so depressed and despondent about their whole status situation, and I do not think that all of them will be able to get back on an education track. So bottom line, is there a way to get rid of that particular threshold that unfairly eliminates a lot of wonderful young people?
Thanks for your questions, Julia. So I'm going to ask Xuming to first take a crack at the first question particularly, or maybe even the second one.
Okay. I mean, yeah, you raised a lot of good points about how people are criminalized for status-based related offenses and how many people are reentering the country just to reunite with their families and because they've been in the U.S. for so long. And so unfortunately, the bill actually expands the penalties, the federal criminal penalties for illegal entry and illegal reentry in terms of the jail time or prison time that a person would serve. And yeah, it's very troubling because there's another section of the bill in the border enforcement section which also increases the number of people that would get criminally prosecuted each day for illegal entry or illegal reentry. So that's definitely very troubling, and I know people have identified that as an area we're concerned about. Unfortunately, right now those people would be excluded from the legalization path, so I think it is something that we have to really advocate around. For your second question, there is a hardship exception for the two-year college requirement. If a person has compelling circumstances, they don't have to go to college for 2 years or serve in the military for 4 years. We're not sure what people are going to have to show to meet this exception. Another idea that's been tossed around is because in previous Dream Act, there was a volunteer service or community service provision where if somebody did a certain number of years of community service, that could be an alternative to higher education. So I think that's also a potential idea for ways that we can change the Dream section.
Great. And Julia, just one other comment. This is Maria Elena. The Dream section of the bill is definitely the best Dream Act that we've seen ever since 2001 that we've been working on this issue. And it's probably one of the, not probably, it is one of the core agreements that the Senate Gang of Eight agreed to, led by Senator Durbin, of course, which means that very few amendments will probably be allowed on that. And I'll talk a little bit more about that as we wrap up. But thank you so much for your work and for your questions.
Thank you so much.
Zach, next question.
And we'll go next to Tessa Levine with MUA. Please go ahead.
Hey, I'm Tessa calling from Mujeres Universitarias in the Bay Area. I have a question about what proof of employment is going to look like, especially for women. We work with a lot of domestic workers, and I know there's a lot of concern around having to prove continuous employment, and so I'm wondering what kind of proof is going to be acceptable in the current bill and if there's any chance for amendments.
Great. Thank you, Tessa. Yep, this is one of our great concerns. So, Josh,
I mean, we here at NILC have grave concerns about the regular employment requirement during the RPI period, both substantively in terms of a person's ability to maintain 10 years of continuous employment without any periods of unemployment longer than 60 days, but also, as you mentioned, in terms of a particularly lower wage workers' ability to document that continuous employment. So we're not clear on exactly what sort of evidence would be required, although we are looking to our experience under the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program as instructive, since one of the evidentiary issues there was for DACA applicants to prove 5 years of continuous residence. And so I think we know from that process the sorts of evidence, of documentary evidence that CIS accepted, and we are presuming that will be somewhat similar here, although we don't know for sure yet.
Mm-hmm. Great. Thanks, Tessa. Did you have another question?
Just, is the recording of this call going to be sent out to everyone who RSVP'd?
Yes. Yep, we'll definitely be sharing it.
Great. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, and thanks for all the great work that MUA does. One more question I think we have time for, Zach.
We'll take our last question from Louis Nico with the Law Offices of Robert Martinez. Please go ahead.
Yeah, good afternoon. I just have two real quick questions. One is, I was wondering if you could speak about these triggers to initiate the adjustment of status period that the bill speaks about. And the other one is regarding the amendment, the definition of immediate relative and the expansion of the married sons and daughters to include only sons and daughters who are over the age of 30, who are under 31 years of age. I'm sorry.
Great. Yep. Thanks for your questions, Louis. Do you want to
shoot me? Sure. So, I mean, there's several triggers in the bill. One is just for even the RPI legalization process to begin. The secretary has to certify that there's a new border strategy plan is going to have to begin. And so there's a secondary trigger once people are ready to adjust to their LPR status. At that point, there's four criteria that have to be met. So there's two border plans that basically have to be implemented and be more or less substantially operational. The mandatory E-Verify program that Josh was talking about has to be in place, and also the Department of Homeland Security has to set up an electronic exit system for people entering and leaving the U.S. at different points of entry. So, there are several requirements before people can be able to adjust to their LPR status. And
if I may, real quick, did I read something about 90% of the high priority needs to have been reached before that recommendation can be made? Would that be a little bit too – is that bar set up a little high where it could delay the adjustment of status through this program?
Yeah, that's one of the concerns. That's one of the goals of the border plan, is that 90% of the people who are attempting to cross into the U.S. have to be apprehended. But, you know, if you look at current migration to the U.S., it's actually net migration from Mexico is zero in terms of the number of people entering versus the number of people voluntarily leaving or getting deported.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not quite clear. We might be close to that goal at this point, mm-hmm. but I think what's really troubling is that that's even set up as a goal, and that so much money, you know, up to $6.5 billion is going to be allocated towards these border goals.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I think on the, as you just mentioned, Louise, the border triggers appear to be more of a goal of reaching that 90%, and according to the Department of Homeland Security and the White House, they seem to be pretty confident that we are almost at that level already. It's almost at like 80% in the particular places that they're looking to focus on. I think one of the ones that we have most concern about is actually on the E-Verify trigger, since that does require all employers. And, you know, going back to Tessa's question, like right now that includes families who are hiring home health support, domestic workers, et cetera. So that is one of the triggers that I think we'll be definitely taking a look at as well.
Right.
Great. Well, thanks again for your questions, everybody. Just a couple of points in response against Tessa. We will be sending out the link to this call and invite you to share it with everybody. We would love to get your feedback as well on the call. So please, if you didn't get to ask a question or we didn't get to your question, or if you have any feedback, comments, please feel free to email us at reply@nilc.org. Again, it's reply, R-E-P-L-Y, at nilc, N-I-L-C.org. And just to wrap up, again, we thank all of you for the incredible work that you do every single day. it really is because of your courageous advocacy and organizing that we've gotten to the place that we are today. We, you know, a year ago, many of us at Milk were, you know, immersed in litigation, fighting and filing lawsuits all over the country against the anti-immigrant laws. We continue to fight those and defend those in court, but the climate has really changed dramatically, and we get every single week, I feel like we're celebrating new victories, particularly at the state level, the latest one being in Colorado. I think there's some of you on the call from Colorado, where the Trust Act, or the I'm going to forget the name of it. The bill was signed into law, and in-state tuition equity bills that continue to get signed into law, driver's license bills. It is really incredible how much the climate has changed, and it's all a testament to the work that you've all been doing. As I mentioned earlier, the Senate bill will be marked up starting next Thursday. We are definitely will be keeping you all informed about the prospects. It's going to be a very, very hard period that we're about to go into. We have to do a lot of work. We need all of you to weigh in with your elected officials. We have a lot in the bill, a lot of gems, as I mentioned earlier, to protect, as well as to try to fight to really try to improve the bill as much as possible. In order to stay informed, please sign up for our listservs, and that way you can get this information directly. I think a number of you got the information forwarded. Please encourage your members and other advocate organizations to sign up, and we will do our best to keep you informed. And the other next stage is that the House will be introducing their bill sometime soon as well. And I don't think I have to say this to any of you, but that will be a much more conservative bill. We're already, based on what we're hearing about, have a lot of reasons to be concerned about. So we will need to work with all of you really closely over the next weeks and next months to make sure that we get the best immigration reform bill possible, and that we actually get a bill passed, and that we not only focus on all of the individuals who hopefully will be included in immigration reform and will be able to have an eventual road to citizenship, but also that we look at how this bill will affect all those individuals who will be excluded or who will be, you know, sent down some detour and end up not being able to get to the finish line and become citizens. So thanks again to all of you for your incredible work, and we look forward to staying in touch. And of course, a final thank you to all of our incredible staff at Milk who've been working arduously over the last weeks and months to get to where we are today. And then, of course, we will continue to work hard over the next weeks along with you. Thanks, everybody. Have a great day.